And welcome to minute 93 of season 8 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today from the Apollo 13 minute and the Rocketeer minute and the upcoming Captain America minute and the producer of all these different movies by minute productions over the last few years. Welcome back to the show, Jim O'Kane.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate being on.
And the airport minute. There you go.
That's
the
one. That's always a good thing.
I knew I got another one there. So, minute 93 begins with Miller giving instructions to the prisoner and ends with Upham once again being shocked by the situation.
Wow.
So we ended things yesterday with three of the men, you know, Ryben, Jackson, and Mellish, starting to beat the crap out of this prisoner because they're obviously, understandably, upset about the fact that that Wade was just killed by them. Upham is the only one who doesn't quite understand the situation, and you know, the prisoner realizes he's about to die, and he just starts, blathering on in German, where no one can hear what they're saying. And then Miller stops the execution and decides that he's got something else for him to do. So he starts giving instructions. He goes, first, make him mark and cover Wade's body for grave detail. Same thing for those paratroopers down there. Strip that stuff off and check him for intelligence. So it goes to show that even after what they've just gone through, Miller is a great commander because, you know, he's pushing his emotions off to the side, unlike the rest of the men. The other men, their emotions have gotten to them, and, you know, they're ready to take their revenge on this guy who presumably, or they know that he was part of the group of people that went ahead and, and they were fighting against, and Wade ended up getting shot from. You know, so the next question that Mellish asks is, you know, he turns to Upham and goes, ask this piece of shit. He's the one who shot Wade. Ask him. And I like the response that he's given. It doesn't matter. And he goes, it does matter. And then Upham starts talking to the prisoner in German. So It's very interesting because, like, what type of answer could this prisoner give? He's going to say one of two things. He's saying, yeah, I was the one who shot your friend. And then, you know, a second later, they're going to shoot him. Yeah, exactly. Or he's going to say, no, of course not. I'm a non-combatant. I'm a non-combatant. You know, like, what? It's a situation where you know that he was part of, you know, the battle. You know, did he shoot him? Did he not shoot him? It's inconsequential at this point. It doesn't really matter. It's not like they're not going to go take it to CSI and check the ballistics and say, okay, spoiler alert, Steamboat Willie is the guy who actually shot Wade. Like, it doesn't matter. We know he was part of the group. He's not sitting there. He doesn't have like a cross on him that he's a. That's right. he doesn't have any symbol on him that he's a medic or something like that. You know, he was there, he was shooting, and that was it. You know, is he the guy who shot him or not? We don't know. We don't care. You know, from that same perspective of the whole thing. Now, what's very interesting is the phrasing of what Miller says. It says, make him mark and cover Wade's body for grave detail. Now, do you have any idea what that means?
I'm assuming that they – well, I mean, I know that the dog tags are duplicates that they split, and you take you take one with you to record it, and then you leave one at the gravesite to denote this is the body that you're going to find underneath here. You know, it's a head – basically, it's a headstone, but it's a little piece of metal that will mark who's on that grave. Cover, I'm assuming, means – you're going to dig a hole and then you're going to bury the body in the hole with a cover of dirt. So I'm guessing that's what Mark and Cover would be.
No, but it's just it's strange that that's the it's Mark and Cover Wade's body for grave detail. It's when he says for grave detail, it makes it seem as if you know this Mark and Cover is some sort of preparation that you do.
Yeah.
You know that's the thing that's strange about the phrase. I mean, obviously, I understand what it is that he wants them to do. He wants them to dig graves for these men, and then we're gonna, you know, we'll cover up the bodies and then mark the grave. But it's just a strange way to phrase it, the way that he says it here.
Yeah. I'm guessing that's standard terminology in the field of how
it... Probably. Yeah, I looked it up, and the only things that came up were this movie. So that's one of the problems when you do searches on phrases from movies, quite often
it's self-referential.
That's right. It's a little more difficult to find that information out from that perspective. So the idea of a marked grave or an unmarked grave. Okay, so the idea of an unmarked grave is one that doesn't have any type of headstone or nameplate indicating who is buried there. Sometimes there are cultures that mark burial sites, but they don't specify who's in each grave. Now, there's also a metaphorical meaning to the idea of unmarked grave. Do you have any idea what that might be?
I'm not sure.
So the metaphorical way of when you refer to an unmarked grave, it means something that basically doesn't have an end.
Ah. I was not aware of that.
You know, it's something that just will go on forever. The idea that you know, because usually having some sort of headstone or something like that, it's a way to show a sign of respect and to commemorate and stuff like that. But when you don't have this, it means it's something that's going to be ongoing forever.
Hmm.
You know, obviously the idea of having a marked grave is that it's a place where someone can go to pay their respects to someone who's passed on and stuff like that. You know, so you want to have the physical place for them to be able to go, to deal, I guess, with their emotions and history and stuff like that. And when it's unmarked, so it could be something that will just be constantly ongoing because you're never going to – you don't have that place to go. You have to find some other type of thing to do. Now, sometimes there are deliberate unmarked graves. A good example would be Osama bin Laden. You know?
Yeah, or General Braddock during the French and Indian War. I know that he was buried at a crossroads so that his body would not be defiled. George Washington buried him outside of Pittsburgh during the French and Indian War so that his body would not be defiled by their enemy. And Washington's job after the war was to go find Braddock's body. I remember that was I had to read that as a short story, which I didn't realize that was, but it was unmarked so that only people in the know would know where to dig up the body later.
Correct. Right. The idea again is that there are also criminals that that they would not put markers on their graves so that people wouldn't go there to show signs of respect.
Yeah.
You know, to criminals and stuff like that, which again goes with what I said about Osama bin Laden. The idea was is that they threw his body into the sea, you know, where nobody will know where it is, so that people can't
build a memorial to
for him. And that's right. There are sometimes positive reasons that people don't want a marked grave. For instance, Genghis Khan requested to be buried without any type of markings because he didn't want it to become a place where people will come and commemorate him and stuff like that. So nobody apparently knows where he's been buried. There are also sometimes celebrities that have passed that that have asked to be buried in undisclosed places where people won't know it's them. Examples, according to this article, Kobe Bryant is apparently not buried somewhere where people know.
Wow.
Michael Jackson, Steve Jobs, George C. Scott, Frank Zappa, Roy Orbison, John Belushi. Basically, from what I understand, they're not completely unmarked. You know, they're marked in some way so that people who are in the know will know how to find them. But, you know, they don't have large markings to say, oh, this is where, you know, John Belushi is. You know, that type of thing. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think John Wilkes Booth and the other Lincoln conspirators are buried inside the walls of the yard of a federal or Navy prison in Southeast Washington, but the graves are not marked, so nobody would go and do a South Shell Rise Again thing around. they're buried somewhere in that zip code, but you can't find them exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also found a list, a very interesting thing, of different markings that people put on graves they're like different emblems that are there that all have meanings and stuff like that, so that you don't have to write something out or whatever it is. So I'll just go through some of them. Let's see if you can try and guess what any of them might be. Again, it's not something that they're not normal things, yeah. So maybe you might not know any of them. Okay, an anchor.
It's Hope, isn't it? I believe it's.
Yeah, very good, very good. Hope. Okay. An arch.
I don't know.
That they are rejoined with their partner in heaven. A book.
I'm not sure.
Wisdom. Hmm. A column.
Column is family, isn't it, or togetherness?
No, noble life. Okay, a broken column.
A broken column means hospitality or welcome.
No, it means early death.
Oh well.
What about a cross, anchor, and Bible?
They sound like Monopoly game pieces. Cross, anchor, faith, hope, and charity.
Trials, victory, and reward. Okay, a crown.
Head of the household?
Reward and glory. A dolphin.
I'm not sure.
Salvation. Okay. An evergreen.
Eternal life.
Very good. Very good. There you go. A garland.
I would say honor and glory.
Well, it's victory over death, but if it's on a gravestone, I don't know if that's considered victory.
Nice try, I guess. I don't. So close.
Exactly. Yeah. A heart.
I would say love.
Devotion. Hourglass.
I guess time is running out. Sudden death.
Time and its swift flight.
Tevis Fugit, yes.
Okay. What else? The lamb.
Lamb, a child.
Right, innocence, or a young age. A lamp.
A lamp. Truth?
Immortality. But again, if it's on a gravestone, probably not. What else? A mermaid.
Mermaid. Mermaid. She you drowned?
dualism of Christ. I don't know where that really how that fits in there. Fully
half
God,
human
fully
and
man.
fish.
I guess so, maybe. What else? A pillow.
Pillow, eternal rest.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. What else? A snake in a circle.
That's an Oribus. It's eternity, isn't it?
The everlasting life. Yeah. A broken sword.
Died in battle?
No, broken sword is life cut short. Crossed swords.
Cross swords, valor?
No, that's life lost in battle.
Wow.
Yeah. A triangle.
Triangle, a trinity.
Trinity or truth and equality?
Or yield, I guess.
A shattered urn.
Shattered urn. Tragedy.
Old age. Okay, and the final one that is on this list, a weeping willow.
New life.
Mourning, grief.
Oh yeah, the weeping
okay.
part.
Yeah. Then they have another one on here that's if you have the symbols alpha and omega.
Okay, yeah, that's eternity, beginning and end.
That's right, beginning and the end. Correct. Then I came across a phrase that I'd never heard of before. Have you ever heard the term a tombstone tourist?
Tombstone tourist? No.
So it's basically people that go around trying to find graves of famous people. You know, they tour different areas.
Okay, I just realized I may have a tombstone tourist in my family. My wife's family is from Canada, from Nova Scotia, and we went shortly after we got married. She wanted to go to Nova Scotia. She hadn't been there since she was a little kid. And I always say that she wanted to introduce me to her relatives. I think we went to every graveyard in Nova Scotia because she's big on genealogy, and she was looking up all the different headstones, different great great grandparents and things like that. So we had a family get together. I mean, we were the only living ones there, so it was interesting. My parents have a different view of cemeteries. I mean, my mom said visiting a cemetery is like going to visit the hair on the barbershop floor. Why?
Okay. It's
very practical about that. And I have a picture. My dad passed about 10 years before my mom did, and he's buried in a military cemetery in just outside of Dallas, Texas. And my mom had a good friend who wanted to go. She would go at least once a week to visit the grave of her husband, who had died years earlier. And she took my mom to the National Cemetery after my dad had passed and been buried there. She took my mom there, and for some reason, she wanted to take a picture of my mom next to my dad's grave and send it to me. And my mom said, I really wasn't sure what kind of face I should pull. I was standing on the grave of my husband. She just found the whole thing absurd. But she sent me the picture. And she said, I guess if you want to show this to the kids, you know, I'm here with your dad's at your dad's grave. And she said, I guess I just should look thoughtful. So she stood over the grave and she's going to look thoughtful. But it's a great picture that I still have of my mom. And I'm, when I see that, I hear her sense of humor, even, you know, in a cemetery about standing over my dad's headstone.
Interesting. Right. So basically Upham starts talking to the prisoner in German. And then Jackson screams out and goes, "Shut up with that filthy pig Latin." And so what's Pig Latin?
Well, Pig Latin is it's one of those things that you learn as a kid, and then some people get it and some people don't. It's basically you're rearranging sounds of words to make it more difficult to understand, especially for if you've got kids and you don't want your kids to understand what you're saying. You move the first sound in the word to the back of the word and add A to it. So if you had the name Jim, it would be MJ. And if you if you want if you don't want your kids to know that you're going to the movies, you can say, "Do you want to okay to the movies, May?" But it's I mean I get
Yeah.
I'm sure
So
people
it's
that use
basically a language, it's a language
yeah.
game, basically. As you said, you'll alter letters here and there, or you'll add some sort of fake suffix, or a prefix or whatever it is in order to think. Now, do you know that it originally was known as something else?
No, is it? I'm guessing. Was it a different animal?
It was a different animal, and I know that I mean, you talked the other day about Shakespeare, so it's Shakespeare who actually in one of his plays used the term in a play that he wrote in 1598.
Really? Okay. I know Shakespeare, but I can't give you the years. So I'm assuming that it's somewhere in there, he was talking about cow Latin or something, or I don't know what the. Another pig. Go, go.
It's in Love's Labour's
Oh,
Lost.
okay.
He refers to dog Latin.
Dog Latin. Okay. It was is
Yes.
does he use it in it? I was just I know I'm gonna have to look up Love, Labor's Lost. Interesting.
Well, the reference is a conversation between Costard and Holofernes, where Costard says, "Go to, thou hast it in dunghill, at the finger's end, as they say." Then Holofernes says, "Oh, I smell false Latine, dunghill for unguim." So, that's, And then in the mid 1800s, it was referred to as Hog Latin.
Ah, okay, getting closer.
Yeah, and then eventually it became known as Pig Latin,
Oh.
which was in the late 1800s they started referring to that.
I've got a question. Rob, you speak Hebrew. Is there a Hebrew version of a pig Latin? Is there a pig Hebrew?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it pig
No, I don't
Hebrew,
think
but
that's
yes,
kosher.
there
Sorry.
is. No, not at all. Yes, there. My kids do have this type of thing where you change around the letters and change around the words, the same type of thing, the same type of game.
Okay.
But yes, it is not referred to as pig
Yeah,
Hebrew,
okay.
because you are correct. That would
Yeah,
not be
not
kosher.
kosher. Okay, yeah.
Exactly,
Wow.
but good catch there. Good catch.
Intriguing.
I guess it's a universal thing that you just change
Yeah,
the, you change
move
around the
the
letters.
sounds around. Wow.
Exactly.
Okay, now I'm gonna have to look up every language and find out what they're. I'm sure that every language has some version of that where you add a letter or swap it out the phrase.
Yeah, that's right. So there are two Pig Latin words that are known as mainstream American English words. Do you have any clue what they could be?
Let me think. Hang on a second. Oh wait, I know what this is. I know. Is one it There's more than one?
There are two. There are
Okay.
two.
Ixnay.
Ixnay, very good.
Okay. I don't know what the other one would be, but Ixnay would be the one that I would guess. Ixnay on the yeah. I don't know.
Well, actually, they're both Ixnay, but they're just spelled differently.
Oh,
Okay,
okay.
right. So there's one that's Ixnay and Ickssnay, which is the Pig Latin version of the word Nix, Nix,
Ixnay, yeah.
which is used to to as a negative. And the other one, sorry, there is another one. The other one is Amscray.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's like in Fire Sign Theater. The Adventures of Nick Danger, Amscray Uster Bay. It's a Scram Buster. Yeah, so, Amscray.
That's
I didn't realize that was a common thing.
Scram, go away, get out of here. Yeah.
Yeah. Amscray. Yeah. Okay, Amscray and Ixnay.
Yeah.
The stuff you learn on this show. Wow.
That's right. Okay, so here, I found a list of other languages of what they call their Pig Latin.
No.
So in German, their version of Pig Latin is called Kedelklappersprook.
Wow.
Brook. Okay. In Sweden, it's known as Fickensprocket.
Wow.
Which is like fig language. In Finnish, it's known as Kantinkieli. In Italian, it's called Alfabeto Farfallito. Farfallino.
And that's in what? What language?
In Italian.
Oh, in Italian. Okay. Farfallito.
Alfabeto Farfallino.
Wow.
In Spanish, it's known as Jeringanza. In Latin America, the Spanish there, they use something called Vesery. The Slav in the Balkans, it's called Satra.
Huh.
In France, it's known as Lusherbem.
Lusherbem.
Yeah, that's the whole list. It doesn't talk about the Hebrew Pig Latin.
Huh.
Sorry.
See? Well, there's something to add in the...
Sorry to disappoint. Something for you to look up. Yeah. Something for you to try to find.
Hebrew Pig Latin. Interesting. Yeah.
Exactly.
Does it have a name? Is there a Hebrew word for it?
I don't remember. I honestly don't know what my kids had called it. I couldn't help with that from that perspective.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Well, there's something for the listeners to look up at home. Figure that one out. Wow.
Yeah.
At
this point, Miller then looks over at Jackson and goes, "Jackson, you're hit." And he looks over and he goes, "Oh, shit." He goes, "I guess I just skinned the arm, sir." He goes, "Get it cleaned and dressed." And the Miller turns to Ryben and says, "You and Sarge, watch the perimeter." And then, Upham continues speaking German with the guy. And then Upham says, "Sir," he says, "please don't shoot him." And Miller just looks at him and goes, "I don't care what he says, Upham. Sir, you're going to let them kill him? This is not right, sir." And Miller just looks at him and gets really angry and goes, "You can help him with the bodies." And Upham he's completely confused here. He doesn't know why this is all happening. I mean, I like the fact that they have given us a character who is supposed to be, quote-unquote, the conscience
yeah,
here.
Yeah, he's our organizing sensibility.
Correct. But again, you know, in the end, we know that his character is in the wrong here.
Yeah.
You know, because had he not fought for saving Steamboat Willie, the outcome of this movie would have been very different.
Yeah. And he's surprised that Miller is taking the side of the other officers or the other soldiers. That
That's right.
You're supposed to be the good guy.
Right. Right. I mean, it's interesting the way that they show us this moral question. And so we have this one character who is okay. We have to be moral. We have to be able to keep this guy alive. And you know, then you see the consequences of that. You know, yeah, later on. So this movie's theme brings up a lot of questions as to what is right and what is wrong during war.
Yeah, it's morally gray because sometimes doing the wrong thing is the right thing, and vice versa.
That's right. That's right, but he frames it really well here, you know, the way that this comes across.
Yeah, yeah, Upham is being the upright one when that was as we'll find out later, was a big mistake.
Correct. You know.
And I think I found the Hebrew Pig Latin. It's called the Beth game. You add the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Beth. You add a B after each vowel, which sounds incredibly difficult to do. Just reading, if you say Ane Ohev Otax, which is I love you, it becomes Abanibi Obahebev.
No. It's a song.
Oh, it is.
Abani Biavarobet. It's a song that won the Eurovision contest in 1979.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, but
apparently
Abani Biavarobet. Yes. You're right. It's a question of adding a letter at the beginning of the whole thing. Yes. Thank you very much for reminding me of that.
I don't think I have the mental ability.
You do.
I will have to learn how to do that. That looks incredibly difficult. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than English Pig Latin. Wow. Okay.
Well, no, it's more difficult for you because you don't speak the language.
That's true.
I think that's part of what it comes down to.
That's true. Maybe if I knew the words better, I would be able to say.
So you see, your mission before next season is to teach yourself the language, and then we can talk about Ibi Obanoma.
Yes. There you go. Well, yeah. Well, I told you, I already growing up, I knew how to play Shimon Aram. Simon Says in Hebrew. But
you know how to play dreidel, I know.
Yeah, I can play a dreidel and I can do Simon Says, but that I'll work on my Hebrew vocab for next season.
Your Hebrew Pig Latin.
Yes, I'll get that Beth game down cold pat. Maybe I'll just learn the song.
There you go. That's probably a little easier, yes.
Wow. Well, this has been a wide-ranging minute.
Of course. Isn't that what people are talking about?
Yeah, it's a cornucopia of knowledge.
That is correct. Okay, so that's all I have for this minute. Did you have anything else you wanted to discuss?
I think we have spread far and wide. That's fine. We did good on this minute.
Okay. All right, excellent. So every Wednesday we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II movies.
Okay, well...
So, Jim, again, I'm sorry that I gave you so much homework,
I can do this part. I don't have to add a B in every word. So, my five World War II films that I can strongly recommend all of them watching. Number five is the great 1962 film, The Longest Day. And The Longest Day was one of the more, it was a great first go at collecting what D-Day was like on the from both the Allies and the German points of view. It was kind of evenly long, so make sure you pack and be ready with lots of popcorn for that film. Great movie, great acting.
Right.
Kind of weird casting.
It's true. My favorite piece of trivia about The Longest Day, and anyone listening. Over the last 93 episodes has probably heard me say this before, but you might not know this, is that the director of the producer of the movie The Longest Day had more people under his command than all of the Allied generals did during the Battle of D-Day itself.
Wow. Holy smokes. Wow. Well, it's a great film. I can strongly recommend it, and it's filmed with a lot of people who were World War II veterans. So interesting to watch. A little bit of stunt casting. John Wayne was a bit much for the role, but I enjoy that a lot. Number four, semi-factual, the film The Great Escape. Lots of fun acting, lots of adventures, lots of side quests going on with it. And
I've heard of that one.
Yes. Great film.
And there's a great podcast about it.
Yes, I think so. So,
which you've been on.
Yes. So I can strongly recommend both the film and the podcast is worth listening to and watching. Number three is my most recent one. I would say the 2019 version of Midway. Brilliant film. It's absorbing. It's extremely very much. It's almost like a video game. It's like you are there. The camera work is excellent. The storytelling is just Midway is a very difficult battle to understand because there's really four parts to the battle, and trying to get it all up on screen so that people who are not familiar with what was going on can follow. They did a great job explaining it and putting it in very human terms. So I can recommend that 2019 Midway. Number two is a great platoon type film called Battleground. Battleground. I really enjoy that film. Ricardo Montalban is in it too. He does a great job. It's about the Battle of the Bulge. It's about the 101st and the 82nd in this terribly cold time in Belgium. Battleground really captures. If you enjoy the feeling of being a part of a platoon, the way it is in Saving Private Ryan, seeing Battleground really does it for getting you on the ground. You'll feel the cold of Bastogne if you're watching Battleground. And number one, which is arguably not a World War II movie, but to me it's the most World War II movie ever made, and I think you may have heard of this one, Rob. It's The Best Years of Our Lives, made in 1946.
I think I've heard of it.
Okay, maybe it's been around. It's directed by a fellow named William Wyler, who spent a lot of time in the nose of a B-17 during World War II with a camera.
Yeah, I think I heard his daughter talking about the movie or something.
Something like that. There may have been a podcast with one of the few surviving, actually the only surviving known cast member being on the show, who happens to have been the daughter of William Wyler. But if you haven't seen The Best Years of Our Lives, I don't think you've had a complete cinematic experience of understanding the history of American cinema. Best Years of Our Lives.
I completely agree with you.
It's the first modern movie. I think this movie captures so much of the human experience and some frighteningly realistic performances by people who were part of it. Big kudos to Harold Russell, who plays an armless Navy man who happens to be an armless Army veteran. And this movie, if you're not left in tears or you didn't experience the film, but I can strongly recommend that. Put that on your must-see list. Anyway, that's my five.
All right, that is a great list. Thank you very much for that. So, Jim, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Yes, please set aside December and the next 8 months after that, because we're going to be coming up 3 days a week with a show about one of my favorite Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, Captain America: The First Avenger. On the Captain America Minute, me and my co-host Hal Bryan and my new co-host Brian Fees are going to be talking about all the aspects of not only Captain America, but most of the characters of the Marvel Universe. So join us there for an in-depth discussion. And we're also going to have Joe Johnston, the director, with us, who's along for the ride, and a couple surprise guests. You'll be interested to listen in. So check that out, capminute.com.
All right, excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.